Live on Tape, Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between. With award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. Here are your hosts, Tom and Charles.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Work in Progress. I'm Tom Alexander. And of course, as always, I am joined by my good friend and podcast partner. It is Charles Epstein. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom. Today's guest is John Hyman, a nationally recognized employment and labor attorney, author, speaker, blogger, and most importantly, a friend of the pod, as I believe this is his third appearance, which is a record for a non-World at Work person.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So looking forward to having John on. And he is a partner in the Labor and Employment Group at Myers, Roman, Friedberg, and Lewis. And according to his LinkedIn profile, he is a master of workplace schadenfreude. Tom, I think it's safe to say that when it comes to workplace schadenfreude or schadenfreude generally, unlike John, we're just devoted practitioners of the dark art. I don't think we've achieved mastery. I don't think, but one day.
Well, not for a lack of trying. Maybe we can ask John what we need to do to elevate our game, Charles. What we need to do to kind of, reach his level.
Yes. You know, we delight in the misfortune of others as much as the next guy.
Schadenfreude. From the German words Schatten and Freude, damage and joy. It means to take spiteful, malicious delight in the misfortune of others.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking the difference is that, maybe we're a little bit more ad hoc and not as systematic in its application.
Or ad hack for that.
Ad hack.
Yeah, possibly. Anyway, we'll find out soon enough as John joins us right after these words. Stay tuned.
Now's the time our stock has been me done.
Data, the mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it. 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Without further ado, we welcome nationally recognized employment and labor attorney and friend of the pod, John Hyman, who joins us today from Cleveland, Ohio. John, welcome. Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. Please say hi to my podcast partner and good friend, Charles Epstein.
Charles, how are you?
I'm doing well, John. Thanks. Nice speaking with you again. The last time we spoke, I mentioned how outrageous it is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame had yet to induct Jethro Tull, Todd Rundgren, Warren Zevon, and Graham Parsons. I think you had added a couple of others to your list. They've since made a slight correction by inducting Mr. Rundgren, so at least that's a little progress. And no complaints regarding Tina Turner and Carole King, who were among this year's batch of inductees. Any thoughts on any of the other 2021 inductees? And by the way, as a friend of the pod, we'll give you 60 seconds to enthusiastically endorse or freely rant, entirely your choice.
That's a lot of pressure. I was excited about the Go-Go's. I think it's a band that often goes overlooked. They were ahead of their time in terms of, they started out really before they became all poppy. I think they were a lot more, they're pop songs and people know like Vacation and We Got the Beat and what they were, the kind of right. The big MTV songs from the mid 80s. a lot of punk influences in the Go-Go's. I think it's a band that I think was long overdue to get its due. And I was, aside from, I think Carole King is a worthy nominee, I was excited to see Tina Turner get in as a solo artist. But I think of all the bands that got in, I think the Go-Go's had me the most excited, because it's a band that I think is a lot more influential than people give them credit for, being this kind of all-girl pop punk quintet.
Now, by the way, it occurs to me, I'm going to add the Sparks to my list of glaring omissions, and it occurs to me in part because there's one documentary coming out on them, and I think the Sparks actually are doing their own movie. I'm not sure exactly on what, and I was a big fan of their work in the 70s, and they're still going. And the documentary actually speaks to the influence they've had over those many years. So I'm going to add that to my list of glaring omissions. But
yeah, and if you or your listeners have not yet seen the Go-Go's documentary, it's been running on Showtime, I think, is the service it's been carrying it. It's a great watch about the history of the band, the breakup of the band, some of the issues that they had throughout their years.
You know, it's interesting. I don't want to belabor this, but recently on a lark, I picked up a collection of Lester Bangs pieces, and I read Lester Bangs pretty religiously back in the day, in the 70s, when he was writing for Cream and Rolling Stone. And in going through it, I was kind of disappointed. It felt like his stuff didn't hold up all that well. It was like a lot of gonzo free association stuff. And then I realized, you know what? It's not so much that his stuff didn't hold up. Maybe I didn't hold up, or you know, maybe it was great and it was written for people who were in their teens and really enjoyed sort of the illicit or what it felt to be the illicit initiation into that world via the gonzo writing of Lester Bangs. So it was kind of interesting to realize, no, it wasn't so much that his writing didn't hold up, but I just got older and it just doesn't speak to me anymore.
I'm going on vacation in a couple weeks, and I'm looking for books to take on vacation. And one of my favorite books growing up was Joseph Heller's Catch 22. And I'm thinking maybe taking that down on vacation with me for a reread. And a lot of people say that as you get older, that book does not hold up very well. So I'm curious. I haven't read it since my 20s, so I'm curious to read it now. And I think it's probably the book I've read the most number of times. But I'm curious now that I'm approaching 50 to reread it to see if people's suggestion that it might not hold up as well as you get older holds true.
Yeah. You know, it's actually kind of fun revisiting books from your youth and seeing whether or not they do hold up. And sometimes you're surprised they do. I've done that any number of times over the last 5-10 years. Sometimes, you know, you're disappointed, but sometimes you're pleasantly surprised. I was pleasantly surprised. For instance, I went back to some Kurt Vonnegut. I thought, well, I read them in, you know, as an adolescent, basically, when I read them, and they held up. You just view them through a different lens, through your experience, and they're enjoyable, but in a very different way. And just last thing on that, I know we're one digression to another. I recently saw a Hemingway documentary, which I think was done by Ken Burns, which is really kind of interesting. Covered a lot of territory that I already knew, but I figured, you know, he's another guy that I've kind of long dismissed as far as, you know, I read him back in the day and he was probably somebody who wasn't going to hold up all that well. So he's one guy I'm going to go back to. So that should be an interesting process. It's fun to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, before we get into it, Master of Workplace Schadenfreude, we asked you about this the last time you were on. For those with short-term memory issues or those who didn't tune in the first time, briefly describe what you mean by Master of Schadenfreude, and how does one achieve master status? Is there a test or a formal ceremony, John?
It was a fabulous ceremony in some German castle by some Duke of Bavaria, I think, something. I don't know what they called him in Bavaria. Schadenfreude is a German expression for taking joy in the misery of others. It's what I do for a living, essentially. I mean, I represent employers. Often employers are coming to me when an employee has done something horrifically wrong and needs to be fired, or the employer has done something horrifically wrong and has gotten sued by an employee for some form of discrimination, whatever, retaliation, what have you. And, you know, I put a roof over my head and feed and clothe my children and send them to private school based on the mistakes that employers and employees make every day. And so in a perfect world, employers would treat all employees with the respect and dedication that they deserve for the hard work they do. And employees would never do stupid things that justify them getting fired. But our world is far from perfect. And you know, thankfully for the mortgage bill that comes due every month, there's lots of employers and employees that do really dumb things that keep me employed. So
in other words, not to put too fine a point on this, John, it's not so much that you take delight in the misfortune of others so much as you profit from the misfortune of others.
Probably more accurate. Yeah, but I couldn't find a German, and German is so inventive. There probably is a German phrase for that, but sure Schadenfreude seems to fit the best. So,
okay, thanks for clarifying.
John, your LinkedIn page, an award-winning Ohio employer law blog, which is ohioemployerlawblog.com, that makes sense, are two of the go-to places when major decisions on employment and labor law break and people are debating related controversies. I have to say, unlike most corners of the online world, they're oases of rational thought and mostly civil discussion. So we thought we'd just pull from your LinkedIn page several of the most recent issues you've raised and discussed. You recently mentioned a hospital system that survived a legal challenge by 117 of its employees to its mandatory vaccination policy and raised the question, how do you develop and implement a COVID-19 vaccination policy for your employees? So my question is, how do you? What's the first steps there?
Yeah, so first things first, the lawsuit was fascinating. It was, as you said, 117 employees. They were the kind of less than 1% holdouts of Methodist Hospital in Houston that had made the decision that we're a healthcare provider. We believe in the vaccine. We believe in science. We're going to require all of our employees to get vaccinated. We think it's the right thing to do. We think it sends the right message to our customers, our patients, that we believe in the vaccine and we're getting vaccinated. You should get vaccinated too. And these 117 employees held out. They said, you can't force us to get vaccinated. We have, you're invading our privacy. They trotted out the Nuremberg code, which to me was the most offensive part of the whole lawsuit. It was a code that was put in place after the Holocaust, after World War II, in response to the medical experiments that Joseph Mengele and the Nazis were doing on their concentration camp victims, and basically saying that you can't conduct medical experiments on people without their consent. And these 117 employees and others around the country have mistakenly said, you know, this is an experimental vaccine. You can't force us to get vaccinated. You are violating the Nuremberg code by imposing this vaccine as a condition of employment. I would just point out, number one, that is a gross misreading and bastardization of the Nuremberg code. That is really, really, really offensive, given what that code was written in response to. And nobody is forcing those employees to get the vaccine. They are being given a choice. You can get the vaccine and keep your job, or you can voluntarily decline the vaccine and go work somewhere else. That's their choice to make. Those 117 employees made their choice, and they lost their jobs. They lost their jobs as a result. In terms of drafting a COVID vaccination policy for your workforce, I think there's really five things that a business has to think about in drafting and rolling out that policy. Number one, and as illustrated by that Methodist Hospital case, are you going to require the vaccine to be mandatory, or are you simply going to recommend that your employees get vaccinated when they're eligible to do so? I think legally, you can absolutely mandate the vaccine, as that case pointed out. There's no issue with that, so long as you make allowances for disabilities under the ADA or religious accommodations under Title VII, you can absolutely legally mandate that vaccine. Practically speaking, there's reasons why you may not want to mandate it. You may have, you know, good employees who are anti-vaxxers that you might just say, if you don't want to get vaccinated, keep working, but work from home or wear a mask. So there's practical reasons why you may not want to mandate it, but legally within your right. Where are you going to offer the vaccine? The CDC allows employers to offer the vaccine on site. If you're a large enough employer that can tolerate a vaccine clinic, you may choose to do that. If you're going to offer the vaccine offsite, are you going to pay your employees for the time they spend getting the vaccine, those non-exempt employees who are on the clock? I recommend that employees pay for that time. I don't think you want employees choosing between a paycheck and vaccination. I think the vaccine is too darn important given where we are with the pandemic. Are you going to pay employees for time off related to the vaccine side effects? I think, again, that's an easy yes. You don't want employees, again, choosing between, I don't want to risk getting sick for a day or two after the shot, so I'm not going to get the shot. I think that you want to offer that paid time off as an incentive to get employees vaccinated. And then lastly, what other incentives might you want to offer to try and get employees vaccinated? We've seen lots of creative ideas around the country. Ohio, my state, did the vaccine lottery, although I just read a report this morning that was published, I think, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, that suggests that the Ohio vaccine lottery did nothing to move the needle on the vaccination rate in my state, that our vaccination rate pre and post lottery tracked vaccination rates nationwide. And so the suggestion is that the Vax-a-Million did zero to move the vaccine needle in Ohio. But employers are doing other things internally, days off from work, gift cards, financial bonuses, et cetera, all of which the EEOC has signed off on as perfectly legal to try and get folks vaccinated.
Very interesting. To follow up, you asked your readers for creative ideas to incentivize more people to get vaccinated. Can you share with us maybe one or two of the most creative ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best solution that was posed was kind of a combination of kind of the carrot and the stick, along with maybe some kind of endorsement. So you give off, you provide some kind of incentive, whether it's, you know, a day off or a gift card or, you know, something, some grease in an employee's pocket to motivate them to go ahead and get the vaccine. The stick for those that don't get the vaccine, and maybe that's you have to continue wearing a mask. Maybe it's you can't go to certain social events because we're only allowing vaccinated people. Some disincentive for those that don't get vaccinated. And then people are also big on the idea of the endorsement, whether it's, you know, actors or athletes or, in the Methodist Hospital case was the CEO of the hospital coming out strongly in support of the vaccine, but someone that employees look up to and respect. I suggested Tom Hanks. I mean, who doesn't love Tom Hanks, right? As the person to go out and do this kind of public service campaign in favor of people getting vaccinated. But those were the most common themes that I saw throughout the comments that came in terms of what it might take to get people vaccinated. I think the conclusion that I've come to, unfortunately, is that I think by this point, those that have gotten vaccinated are going to get vaccinated, and those that are holding out for whatever reason, it's against their religion, they don't believe in the vaccine. They think it's experimental. They think Bill Gates is, you know, implanting 5G transmitters. You know, somebody on one of my LinkedIn posts called me an agent of, you know, an agent of the Illuminati because I advocate for the vaccine. And you know, I'm still waiting for that check from the global elite to come in, right? So I can I can upgrade the car and do a couple things around the house that hasn't
post-dated, of course.
That hasn't quite shown up yet, and my 5G reception is also not improved since I got vaccinated. So, and I have not gotten magnetized yet. So, all these things that, and my superhero status and my check have not come in yet since I've taken Pfizer juice. So there's people have all sorts of reasons why they don't want to get vaccinated, and I think unfortunately those that haven't probably won't, which is unfortunate because we're now seeing. You know, and a lot of people then also say to me, you're vaccinated. Why do you care? If the vaccine works, as you say it works, and you're protected, then you're protected and leave us alone. Why do you care if we get vaccinated? And I care because the vaccine works for now. We're now seeing the spread of the Delta variant. We think the vaccine is going to hold against the Delta variant. But as more people are unvaccinated and more people get infected with the virus, the virus is going to mutate. That's what viruses do. That's what epidemiology science tells us viruses do to survive, is they keep mutating, getting more virulent, more dangerous in order to survive. And so the Delta variant will become the Epsilon variant, which will become, I don't know my Greek alphabet after Epsilon. I don't know what comes next after Epsilon, but whatever comes after Epsilon.
Zeta.
You know, will, what's that?
Zeta.
Zeta. Okay. Zeta. Yeah. And then on and on and on. Eventually, the virus is going to evade my immunity. And so the vaccine is going to protect me now, but it might not protect me in the future. And the boosters, the companies might be behind the eight ball on the variants. And so I care because your recklessness is ultimately going to be dangerous to me. And so that's why I care. And that's why we need to get as many people vaccinated as possible to ultimately snuff this thing out, or we're just going to be living with COVID forever. Maybe that's where we're going to be.
Yeah. I think somebody who asks you why you're concerned after you get your vaccination and you're okay, says more about them than anything, because it's not so, I mean, it's partly what you're saying, but we're also looking for the full functioning of our society, and only when we.
Yeah. And it's hard. I mean, we've now reopened like 100%. Pretty much nationwide. I think it was too much too soon, given the number of unvaccinated people. I mean, I still wear a mask when I go out in public, when I'm indoors, grocery store, Costco, whatever. I frankly assume, even though the CD says that the people who are masked or the people that are vaccinated can go unmasked and the people that are unvaccinated should continue to wear masks, I actually assume the converse is true, and that when I'm out in stores, that the people who are wearing masks are actually the ones with the vaccine, and the ones not wearing masks are the ones who are unvaccinated. Because I think there is, if you draw a Venn diagram of people that don't believe in masks and don't believe in the vaccine, there's probably a large correlation in the middle. So I don't know. We saw my son's cardiologist. We went to Philly a couple weeks ago, Father's Day weekend, to see my parents, who we hadn't seen in 20 months. And we mixed in a visit with my son's cardiologist, who practices out of Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, while we were there. And her comment to us was, at this point, it's abundantly clear that you will either get vaccinated or you will get COVID, that there's no other middle ground, that if you're not vaccinated, you will get the virus. And it's a roll of the dice. You might be asymptomatic and fine. You might end up, feeling pretty lousy for a couple of weeks. You might end up in the hospital, on a ventilator, and you might die. And you might be asymptomatic and feel fine, but give it to someone else who is going to end up in a hospital on a ventilator and maybe die. And so it's a complete roll of the dice. And so when we know the vaccine is 99 or 90, 95 plus percent effective against the virus, and almost completely effective against a serious incident of the virus, why you don't want to, and it's safe, why you don't want to take the vaccine and instead would rather roll the dice on getting sick and not knowing how that's going to present. It just, to me, it makes no sense at all.
Yeah, we're just at a very, very strange point in our society. We're due in large part because of the internet. People have access to all this information. You can get it. It's all at your fingertips, which also means that we also have access to fake news and the opposite of reliable information.
Yeah, so, you can really go online and find anything to support the position you want to take at this point, and then it's online, so it becomes the truth. And so,
right.
So you go to InfoWars and you pull up an article that's completely crazy, but then it's you live in your own kind of knowledge vacuum.
Right. That's confirmation bias.
Yeah, right. So, but we've also now live in a society for that reason where I think ignorance has become acceptable. It's it's okay to be ignorant of the facts and be ignorant of reality because you can go find something to confirm your own ignorant viewpoint. And that to me is very, very, very scary in terms of where that's going to lead us.
Yeah, it's part of your personal brand. You know,
I guess.
It is. I see it all the time. We see it all the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a whole entirely other conversation.
That's our spinoff show.
Yeah.
Ignorance isn't bliss. The podcast coming 2022.
Yeah, exactly. Conspiracies in progress. The ABA Journal recently published a column by Susan Smith Blakely, a career counselor and former law firm partner, titled "Are Women Lawyers Paying Enough Attention to Upward Mobility?" The article argues that women lawyers are responsible for the limited opportunities their employers have fostered upon them, or I guess foisted upon them. By focusing on family instead of firm, she argues they have chosen their priority and should not complain when career advancement passes them by. I know that you, John, had a very, how shall we say, emphatic response to this.
Yeah, I thought her column was appalling. For multiple reasons. I thought it was appalling that the ABA Journal allowed it to be published, number one. It's the official journal of my profession, the American Bar Association, the trade organization of my profession. It's their magazine. And I was appalled that their editor let that story go to press with what was, I mean, a milquetoast disclaimer at best. This is the opinion of the author and doesn't reflect the opinion of the editorial board or the magazine or whatever. Late yesterday, after like a week of backlash against that column, the president of the American Bar Association published her rebuttal, which was great. And you can go on my blog today and find a link to it. It's a great rebuttal. It should have been said a week ago. It should have been, I support the idea of having a dialogue around these issues. But that rebuttal should have been published along with the original column. So that opinion wasn't out there for a week left unrebutted by the American Bar Association. So that's point number one as to why it was, I think, embarrassing and appalling. And then just the position itself, that to blame the victims, that women who are, and I'll expand it to not just women, but parents who are choosing to have a family, that are then being punished for that choice by not having certain career opportunities. To me, it's parenting and working are not mutually exclusive. It is, you can and should be able to do both. And when you start a family, you should not, that is not a signal that you are at the same time sacrificing your career. And law firms, no doubt, need to do a much, much, much better job of being inclusive for parents instead of excluding them by putting them on the mommy track or the daddy track or the parent track, which limits their career opportunities. And to come out and blame parents for the decision to become a parent instead of offering a solution to allow for career advancement and be a parent at the same time, to me was just disgusting.
Our guest is John Hyman, a nationally recognized employment and labor attorney, author, speaker, and blogger. John, last week, U.S. Olympic athlete Sha'Carri Richardson was suspended for testing positive for marijuana. You quoted a management side employment lawyer whose initial reaction was that she broke the rules and deserved the related discipline. Then he thought, well, gee, you know, that's a really dumb rule. What's your take on this and its implications for employers vis-a-vis drug testing in general and cannabis related testing in particular, which is a growing issue as now 20 states, I believe, have legalized marijuana for adult recreational use?
Yeah, I think it is a dumb rule. I think we can talk about the sports aspect and the workplace aspect. Marijuana will be legal for recreational use nationwide at some point. And whether that changes what the U.S. Olympic Committee or U.S. Track and Field Association does in terms of whether it's considered a performance enhancing drug or not, it's probably not. I don't think anyone would suggest that getting high is going to help her run better or faster.
Unless, by the way, John, they start testing musicians and writers.
Well, I'm opposed to that for sure because I like going to concerts. I think the point here for her is that whether we agree that it's a dumb rule or not, it was the rule that she agreed to when she entered the competition, and she broke that rule. And rules have consequences, whether it's a rule for her as someone trying out for the Olympics or a rule in the workplace. Those rules have consequences, and she has to live up to those consequences. And she has, I think, to her credit, she has. I think the let her run campaign is not hers. It's been brought on by other people that suggesting that she's received unfair treatment. I think she received fair treatment. It's the treatment that she signed up for. She knew that marijuana was a banned substance, and she did it anyway for reasons that she's explained. But it's a rule that she was aware of and broke it, and she's accepted the consequences, and more credit to her for doing that. And the same holds true in the workplace. Just because your state legalizes recreational marijuana doesn't give an employee a right to come to work high, just like an employee doesn't have the right to come to work drunk. I think as marijuana moves from the illegal controlled substance category to the legal for medicinal or recreational or whatever purpose category, I think it moves from thinking of marijuana like heroin, which it's not, to more thinking it like alcohol. It could alter your ability to perform on the job. And for that reason, I think employers will continue to ban employees from using marijuana at work, just like you can't go have the three martini lunch and come back to work. It's not permitted in the workplace for a reason. And whether it's legal in your state for recreational purposes or not, I think it's going to hold true that employers can still and should prohibit it from, or prohibit an employee who's using it from entering the workplace.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, John, the Supreme Court declined to hear the appeal of a school district challenging the right of a transgender student, Gavin Grimm, to use the bathroom that corresponded to his gender identity, leaving in place the landmark Fourth Circuit opinion holding that transgender bathroom restrictions constitute illegal sex discrimination. Why should employers care about this issue?
They really shouldn't, frankly, because I think it's a non-issue. First of all, the law is very clear, particularly after the Bostock decision last year, which said that LGBT discrimination is sex discrimination under Title VII. EEOC recently put out policy guidance making clear that employees have the right under Title VII to use the bathroom corresponds to the gender with which they identify, not necessarily the gender at which they were born. So legally, if someone presents as a woman or identifies as a woman, you have to let them use the woman's room, and vice versa. If they present or identify as a man, you have to let them use the men's room. To me, this is all a solution in search of a problem. I don't see what the big deal is. If somebody wants to use a woman's room, I mean, who cares? I think that the mental health issues that go along with denying people their rights as transgender individuals. I think the mental health issues that go along with that, the increased risk of suicide and other things, is much more detrimental to the health and well-being of those employees than, you know, me walking into the men's room and seeing a transgender person at the urinal or stall next to me. I don't care. To me, it's just not an issue that employers need to be wasting their time worrying about. The law is clear, and to me, it's just a non-issue. That post on when I posted that on LinkedIn, the comments lit up from people that care a lot and got very offended when I suggested that they were being bigots. I said, if you know, how is that different than a whites only water fountain, right? Or a blacks only water fountain. And they did not like that idea at all. And they threw all kind of, when you talk about confirmation bias and information on the internet, you know, threw all kind of stats at me about, you know, sexual assaults in bathrooms of, you know, transgender people assaulting women in bathrooms. And, you know, you're denying me my choice to not have, you know, those people in my bathroom. And to me, those are the same arguments, you know, people made back in the 1950s about segregated water fountains and segregated, you know, back of the bus and all that. I just frankly don't want to hear it. It's 2021 and it's an issue that I just don't think we should have to deal with anymore.
Last question. With so many people working from home, are there issues that employers are going to now be needing to be mindful of?
I think there's a lot of issues that employers need to be mindful of. I think it's a lot of the issues that they've dealt with for the last, you know, 15 or 16 months in terms of, you know, what remote work looks like, what the technology looks like. There's a lot of cybersecurity issues that arise with work from home in terms of the mobility of data and, you know, how people are accessing networks and is your data safe. And so there are all of those issues. But then there's also, I think, significant recruiting and retention issues that go along with work from home versus not work from home moving forward. I just read yesterday that Apple announced that they're going to start bringing people back to the office 3 days a week. They believe Apple has a strong like teamwork culture. They think they're going to work better with people physically in their offices. So they're going to say 3 days a week, you got to be in the office for this idea of collaboration and teamwork. And their employees are not happy. They're happy working from home and want to continue working from home. And so I think as we move out of COVID, as the world opens back up, as more businesses open back up and are bringing people back to work, it is going to be, I think, incumbent upon each business to decide kind of what their culture is. Is that culture one that matches with a full-time work from home, a hybrid work from home, or a no work from home at all? You got to be here because we need face-to-face. You know, we're talking through Zoom, but frankly, if I do another Zoom meeting, you know, I think we're all zoomed out at this point. And so I've been back at work more or less. I mean, I have the flexibility being an attorney, but I've been back at work now for almost 4 months, back in an office. I like seeing people every day. I like having the flexibility to work from home when I need to. But I think every business is going to have to decide for itself what their culture is and how where employees work matches that culture. And with the job market as fluid as it is right now, I think employees are going to be able to find workplaces that match their idea of what's important to them from a culture standpoint. And so I think if you are bringing people back full time or even part time, I think businesses just need to realize that comes with the risk that you might end up losing some employees who value a full time or a more flexible work from home arrangement. You just might lose them as employees, and you might be recruiting a different, you know, from different pools of employees to fill those vacancies if you're saying we need you here all the time.
Thanks, John. Well, we really do appreciate your time. As always, we've enjoyed having you on the program in the past, and thanks again today for coming on.
It's my pleasure. I love doing it, and I'm happy to do it anytime.
Thank you. Our guest today was John Hyman, a nationally recognized employment and labor attorney, author, speaker, and blogger. He spoke to us today from Cleveland, Ohio. This is Work in Progress. Back in a moment.
The mantra of business today. It's nothing new to World at Work. It's no small feat that they've been collecting data on salary issues for its salary budget survey for more than 45 years. Think about it. 45 years. Curious to know how your company stacks up? HR execs in the know rely on World at Work's salary budget survey. Shouldn't you too? Go to worldatwork.org/salarybudgetsurvey to learn more.
Wrapping things up now on Work in Progress, along with Charles Epstein, I'm Tom Alexander. Always enjoy having John Hyman on the show, Charles.
Yeah, so we got off to a good start, noting that Todd Rundgren, after lo these many years, is finally inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And yes, I'm going to have to check out that documentary, The Goo-Goo Girls.
The Go-Go's.
So I need now to particularly check out that documentary. So at least I pronounced the name of the band correctly. Again, his third time on. There's a reason we've had him on three times. Always very interesting. And as you mentioned, his LinkedIn page and his blog are really go-to places. A really civil, smart conversation on a lot of these pressing issues. I know when something breaks, that's certainly one of my go-to destinations. And by the way, on one of his comments about that legal challenge from that hospital system, to go from Mengele, Dr. Joseph Mengele, to vaccinations, that's quite a journey.
That's a leap, huh? Just a little bit. That's a long jump, as we would say in Olympic parlance.
Yeah, but in any case, I'm expecting we'll have him on the fourth time in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, would like that very much. Thanks, to John Hyman for joining us on the show. Next time on Work in Progress, it's Tad Radzinski from Sustainable Solutions. This is Work in Progress for Charles Epstein. I'm Tom Alexander. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.
This has been Work in Progress, a World at Work podcast about work, life, and everything in between, with award-winning radio host Tom Alexander and Workspan's Not Safe for Work columnist Charles Epstein. For more, visit worldatwork.org/workinprogress. That's worldatwork.org/workinprogress. Join us next week for another edition of Work in Progress.